Well, many Michiganians are delighted for Chicago Cubs fans today. I imagine a lot of Michigan residents became Cub fans in the past couple of weeks. We did, even though we are otherwise American League people. The Cubs are the world champs, and the tweet of the day comes from 90-year-old Michigan Congressman John Dingell, who tweets, "No, I didn't see their World Series win in 1908. It's current state here on WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. The 2016 race for the White House has brought out a myriad of viewpoints. We've heard from most of them, Clinton Democrats, Trump Republicans, the undecided, libertarians, and others. But there's one group of Americans who can't vote, those who are in prison. Current State's Brooke Allen spoke with Rihanna Douglas, a former inmate from Oakland County, and with Daryl Woods Sr., an inmate serving time at the Detroit Reentry Center, about their thoughts on the upcoming presidential election.
According to the Sentencing Project, an estimated 6.1 million Americans are forbidden to vote because of felony disenfranchisement or laws restricting voting rights for those convicted of felony-level crimes. In Michigan alone, there are nearly 60,000 people incarcerated. Of that, 44,000 are disenfranchised, and over half of the disenfranchised are African American. Daryl Woods is one of those disenfranchised Americans. After a string of emails with the Michigan Department of Corrections and some technical difficulties, we were able to speak via phone.
This call is from a correction facility and is subject to monitoring and recording.
Hello, Daryl.
Yes, ma'am.
I asked him if he and his fellow inmates were following the race to the White House, and he told me they are watching one thing very closely.
One of the biggest concerns is how the Supreme Court is going to be decided, whether it's going to be based upon the laws or it's going to be based upon the way Mr. Trump is articulating his vision for America in terms of being aggressively discriminating against people, you know, based upon their religion and their background and things of that nature. So many of the guys are concerned about that, you know, because it's you know, it always has been a challenge in the courts.
While he has never officially cast a ballot, Daryl says for the past 26 years he's been in prison, he's been fully engaged in politics, even acting as chairman of the NAACP. And most of the men are politically savvy and worry about many issues as well.
You know, we're deeply concerned about the economy. We're deeply concerned about the wars and all the things that goes on in society, all the fears that some of the people in society have, people incarcerated have those type of fears as well.
I ask him how it feels to not be able to vote in light of his fears and concerns.
Well, it's very frustrating not to be able to exercise your right to vote because we feel that we are paying some form of taxes in terms of when we go to the commissary and when we, you know, use this telephone, this money is being put into the economy, and I think that is empowering, and I think it would help give those who are incarcerated a sense of purpose if they did have the right to vote, you know, because they have been so disenfranchised and disengaged in American society in terms of many of the guys' upbringing in terms of who are incarcerated never really thought about it until they was able to educate themselves on about the importance of voting. A lot of people shed their blood to give Americans a right to vote, and we are Americans as well as anyone else.
I asked Daryl the one looming question that is probably on a few minds. What do you say to people who say the minute you commit a crime, you forfeit your right to vote?
I'm incarcerated, and I'm doing time for the crime that I was incarcerated for. You know, and I don't think that should be forfeited. I think that keeping me franchised, keep me a part of the fabric of society, and also give me a sense of purpose. You know, and many times people who got it, who came to prison, many of them probably have never voted in their life. And if you gave them that opportunity, let them know that they do have a voice and they can be a part of society through voting, that might be transformational for some of them. You know, I know when I learned about the Voting Rights Act, and I know we're on the 50-year anniversary of it, and even the Civil Rights Act, we're on the 50-year anniversary of that as well. When I learned about those things, it was empowering, and I understood what was sacrificed for me to be able to have the right to vote. I think that we should be engaged in that process. And I think it's more rehabilitative than anything, you know. And so I don't think that we should be dealing with retribution to that extent. And we're talking about transformation, and we're talking about reform and rehabilitation, and I think that should be a part of the rehabilitation process.
Daryl is doing life in prison and will likely never be able to cast a ballot in any election. But at his facility and at others throughout the state of Michigan, once you are released from prison, voting rights are restored.
At the facility I'm at, many of the guys who are leaving here, they automatically get their right to vote. And we have hundreds of people who parole out of this facility on a monthly basis. And so those guys are provided classes and resources and to be able to help them in a transition is something that's remarkable now. They understand the importance of this election. This is probably one of the most important elections in American history, you know, because there's a lot on the line right now.
And one person who knows this is Rihanna. Rihanna is a woman. She majored in political science and is surrounded by friends and family. But she does have one thing in common with Daryl. She also knows what life is like behind bars. She did exactly 900 days for a nonviolent crime. Next week, she will be voting in her second presidential election. I ask her what came first for her, the candidates or the issues.
Before that you can make any decision on who you want to vote for, you want to definitely delve into the platforms of each candidate and how they feel on different topics.
Rihanna says Hillary Clinton seems to have a bigger lens when it comes to looking at reforming the criminal justice system.
At the forefront of Hillary's platform is certainly criminal justice reform. And a couple of ways that she's interested in going about that is by ending the era of mass incarceration, which definitely caught my attention. And then, again, defending voting rights, amongst others, like gun violence, immigration reform, environmental reform, et cetera. But those two things really jumped out at me. So when I take a look at her platform, how she wishes to implement the abolition of the era of mass incarceration is basically by overhauling the mandatory minimum policy, ending sentencing disparities, for example, prioritizing treatment and rehabilitation for those who are incarcerated, and promoting successful reentry by formerly incarcerated people. And those are all topics that I feel, having went through the system, are very important. These are things that people talk about on both sides, on the inside. So even employees and correctional officers, they understand the importance of these programs, and also the inmates themselves.
Rihanna says Donald Trump has been less clear about his plan for the criminal justice system.
He portrays himself as a law and order, tough on crime candidate, but he's not released many specifics on how he would handle mass incarceration specifically. We do know that he supports prison privatization, and he's been quoted as stating that he's against the restoration of voting rights for felons. So regardless of the other things that surround each candidate, we'll say extraneous situations that have been coming up in the media lately, to me, I just find it unlikely to vote for somebody who doesn't believe that I should have the right to vote, because if I can't vote, how can I even have an impact on my society or how I want to help the community or have any impact as a member of the community?
Rihanna thinks it should be all about reentry.
We don't have solid reentry programs. I think that people do crimes and they do their time, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's a solid foundation. That's a good system. We just need to tweak that a bit to make sure that these people aren't branded as terrible people for the rest of their lives, that they're able to reassimilate into society. And many of them have the want and the need to be productive members of society. They yearn for that. They just don't have a solid way, a program, a system to do that. And what we see is a high recidivism rate, because after trying so long to do things the right way, many people will revert to criminal behavior. So we need to lower the recidivism rate, increase program funding to help people get in the right mindset before they are released. And then prior to any incarceration, let's take a look at the mandatory minimums policies. We really need to increase program funding where many cuts have been made to rehabilitate these people. And being on the other side of that, I found that even where the funding was scarce, the people who had their heart in it for the right reasons truly try to make a difference and help these inmates. But one thing where we've seen a lot of cuts, especially in Michigan recently, was reentry programs. There are people who were released around the same time as me who have never used a cell phone.
On November 8th, Rihanna will be working as an electronic poll book operator. And she'll be thinking about all those in prison who do not have the right to vote. And she'll be thinking about Daryl. One thing is certain, no matter who becomes president, Daryl and Rihanna will both be paying attention to the criminal justice reform. For Current State, I'm Brooke Allen.
And coming up on Current State, there's a part of Yellowstone National Park known as the Zone of Death because, due to a constitutional loophole, a crime might be committed there that legally could go unpunished. We'll talk to the MSU law professor who first published a paper about the loophole more than 10 years ago and is still trying to get Congress to change it. That's later this hour on Current State. It's Current State on WKAR. Halloween is over, and very soon it's the presidential election. Are we ready to clear the decks and think about the holidays? Well, Thanksgiving is just 3 weeks away, and it's the time of year when people start thinking about donating to their favorite charities, including food banks. Food banks across the country are trying new ways to meet the demand with limited resources. Here in mid-Michigan, the Greater Lansing Food Bank is entering its busiest time of the year. Joining us by phone, Executive Director Joe Wald. Joe, welcome back to Current State.
Good morning, Mark. Nice to talk to you again.
3 weeks till Thanksgiving here, Joe. Do you typically see donations start to pick up about now, or is most of it still ahead of you, or what?
I tell you, this is the season. It's going to start over the next couple weeks and probably run into early January. We're always busy, but this is certainly the busiest time of the year for us.
How much food do you have on hand right now, and is that any kind of indicator as to what kind of holiday season you'll be having at the food bank?
You know, Mark, the good news is we've got a really good quantity of food right now, but it's because we've been purchasing it. There's been a shift in the basic supply of food from us. We used to get most of our food from retailers donating it, and as they've gotten more efficient, we've gotten less food from them, and so we've been able to go out and purchase more food because of the support of the community. And so the good news is we've got a lot of food on our shelves, but it's going out as quickly as it's coming in. And our challenge is to make sure that we've always got enough food to meet that need, which unfortunately seems to be creeping up every year.
How much is that? Try to provide a little more context here. How big an issue is the fact that retailers, grocery retailers, are sending less to food banks?
It's a very big issue. For years and years and years, this has been the staple of what most food banks have relied on. But this is a national issue that we're hearing across the nation from our colleagues. And so we are forced to really look at two new sources. One is the farming community, because we're all trying to get more fresh produce out to people. And when we can't get the food in through donations, you know, we're forced to go out and purchase the food. But again, the good news is, because of our purchasing power, we buy truckload quantities. We don't pay for brands. We get the same food that you and I were to go into the store to get, but we get them for pennies on the dollar. But again, we're only able to do this because of the support of our community.
Is the reduction in retail donations a result of a more efficient supply chain? I'm sitting here thinking that might be the issue.
That's exactly the issue. And so good for them. They have figured out, you know, their waste becomes our treasure. But as they've been able to reduce waste and duplication, it's impacted our supply. So they're doing a better job at what they're supposed to do, but it is impacting our ability to get food in. And so, again, we have to look at new sources.
Ahead of the holidays, we're talking about tackling hunger here in mid-Michigan. It's the time of year when food banks see their largest volume of donations. My guest is Joe Wald, Executive Director of the Greater Lansing Food Bank. I understand that all the forces in play here, Joe, have led you to become more strategic in your planning. What kinds of new approaches are you implementing?
Well, really good question, Mark. And so, you know, we've looked at this over the last year, and we understand that, you know, we need to be accountable to the community when we make decisions. It's got to be based on fact and data. And so we are gathering more and more data. And there's new tools available to us that we are using now to really begin to map where are there pockets of need in the communities we serve. And we serve 7 counties in the center of the state, starting with the greater Lansing area and right up the 127 corridor. And so what we're doing is we're using this mapping tool to identify where there's pockets of hunger and need, and overlaying on that where our current resources are so that we can really target where are we not serving, because that's our role. That's what the community looks to us to do. And so using these tools, you know, we are making decisions now based on data as opposed to kind of gut feel.
And I understand some pretty important data just arrived this week. Tell us about that.
Well, and so on a national basis, we're part of the Feeding America Network. There are 200 food banks in the nation that are accredited by Feeding America. A number of benefits. We get USDA product in that we can then distribute. We get access to grants and access to all types of mentoring and counseling programs. But what Feeding America has done is they have taken a look nationwide at, so where are we today and where do we project we're going into the future? And then we have access to our specific data. And so they are working with us really to set targets for 10 years out. And that really is an amazing tool to help us start planning not only for what we need to do today, but over the next 10 years, what do we need to do? Because we want to be ready to meet the needs of the community. I think the community views us as the experts on issues related to hunger. And so that's what we want to focus our attention on. And we've got these tools now, which we are just starting to look at. Difficult to say where it's going, but I know that, you know, we want to be ready.
Are you generally confident, Joe, about being able to predict the demand and need 10 years out? That sounds daunting.
It is daunting. And I'll tell you what, even if we're a little off, I think the tools are telling us that there is a gap right now. There's a gap between what we're doing and what the need is. And, you know, that gap, if we could meet that gap today, we basically would be in a hunger-free environment. And and that's, you know, that's quite a goal. We know that just feeding people is not going to address all the issues of hunger. And so part of our strategic plan is to identify strategic partnerships around the community, and there are great partners out there, but really to address all the issues that will impact people having food on their plates. And so it's a daunting task. We've got a great team here and an unbelievable community that supports not only us, but all the great not-for-profits in our community. So we're going to use that data. And even if we're a little wrong, I think that we're moving in the right direction.
Let's get back and spend a minute on root causes here. What factors really drive the demand for food?
Well, it's interesting. You know, once upon a time, you know, it was purely poverty. And we would see a lot of people, you know, homeless people that people would think would be the people that would access a food bank. But today, we are seeing more and more working families who have jobs, who have insurance, who just aren't making enough to make ends meet. And so root causes, you know, it's housing, it's education, it's insurance, it's health care, it's wages. I mean, there are so many issues that go into this. It is incredibly complex. And that's why we know we can't solve it by ourselves. And so we want to focus on the areas that we can have an impact, and that's getting food on people's plates, because I think everybody agrees nobody should ever have to question where their next meal is going to come from. And unfortunately, we are seeing more and more veterans. We're seeing more and more elderly people who are retired, who've done everything right, and suddenly one thing goes wrong, and they have a financial crisis. We're seeing more and more children. And so, you know, there's a lot of root causes that go into this, a lot of things that people don't plan on, can't control. But again, you know, our role is to make sure that there's food out there, and that's what we're going to focus our attentions on.
We're talking about tackling hunger here in mid-Michigan. It is, of course, the time of year when food banks begin to see their largest donation volume. Joel Wald is executive director of the Greater Lansing Food Bank. What kinds of food do the people you serve want the most?
You know, we are looking at people asking for more and more nutritious food, more protein, more fresh produce, and that's a major shift. Again, not too long ago, food banks would take whatever they could get, and people would take whatever they could get from the food banks. But, you know, we are looking to get more fresh fruit, better food as far as protein. It's not to say that kids should not have a cupcake or a chocolate cake occasionally. You know, we're not the food police. But we want to make sure that it's a balanced diet for people, and that's what they're looking for. And I'll tell you, there's been a lot of education, and I think it's starting to have an impact.
How often do people donate money in lieu of food, Joe? How does that break down, and which one helps the cause more?
Well, and again, a great question, Mark. You know, we'll take whatever people can donate, but we can stretch a dollar a lot further at the food bank than you and I could individually. So not too long ago, people would go out and buy $10 or $20 worth of food. We can fill up a whole table for that at the food bank where you and I could buy, you know, five items. And so dollars go much, much further in helping us to actually buy the food that's needed. I'll tell you a quick story. I was going to an event supporting the food bank not long ago. I went to my pantry because I wanted to make sure that I contributed. And as I looked at the bottom of the soup cans, they had expired a year ago. And unfortunately, that's what we often get. You know, it's with the best of intentions, but things sit around. And so when we get cash, you know, we can stretch those dollars so much further and really buy the food that's needed. If we need cereal for children, we can go out and buy cereal. If we need canned vegetables, we can go out and do that. And so that is the shift that's taking place, and it certainly helps. And I'll tell you what, every single dollar helps. That's the message that I send to this community. And I get donations from a dollar up to a couple $1,000s. We know this is not a wealthy community, but everybody gives whatever they can. And that's why we're able to do what we do, support our mission of feeding people.
Sometimes people are wary of donating to charities because they hear negative reports about how much of their cash donations, at least, pay for overhead instead of going directly to the cause. What do you tell people about how the Greater Lansing Food Bank handles that?
Well, again, and I'll tell you, I always ask this question when I get calls at home, and some people don't want to talk about it. We're proud to talk about it here. We have audited statements. Independent auditors come in every year, and we've got to submit these audits to Feeding America. But we also have these statements available for the public. Anybody has a question. And I'm pleased to say that at the Greater Lansing Food Bank, less than 5% of every dollar goes to administrative overhead and fundraising costs. So that means 95 cents of every dollar goes to feeding people. That's what the community wants from us, and that's what we do. And it's been a conscious effort for years from our board and from our team here to make sure that we run a lean operation, and that when money comes in, when resources come in, it is used for our mission. 5 cents of every dollar or less is what goes to overhead and fundraising at this organization.
Your fundraising theme for 2016 has been the best gift ever. We want to thank Joe Wald, executive director of the Greater Lansing Food Bank, beginning its annual holiday campaign, its largest fundraiser of the year. Joe, thanks again. Good
Mark,
luck.
It's always great to talk to you and your team, and good holidays to everybody. Thanks so much.
Coming up on Current State, even though the Lansing Symphony and the MSU Choral Union programmed their Friday concert well before Brexit. Where am I going with this, you're wondering? They're performing the anthem of the European Union and British coronation music. We'll speak with the LSO's maestro, Tim Muffett, about pairing Beethoven and Handel later this hour on Current State. .5 WKAR in Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Glad you could join us today. Movies often portray the Old West as a lawless place, and the assumption is that today those places no longer exist. But in 2005, an MSU law professor discovered a loophole in the Sixth Amendment that could allow for potential lawlessness in a remote sliver of land in Yellowstone National Park. At that time, Professor Brian Cault wrote about the loophole in an article for the Georgetown Law Review called The Perfect Crime, and he referred to this 50-square-mile patch of Idaho as the Zone of Death. The article attracted major attention at the time and still attracts attention today, yet the loophole remains unchanged. Professor Brian Cault joins us to explain. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Set this up for a layperson as best you can, Brian. How could the perfect crime be committed in this small patch of land?
Okay, so the Sixth Amendment has a requirement in it that the jury in a federal criminal trial has to be from the state and district where the crime was committed. And the districts that they're talking about are federal judicial districts. And usually most states are just one district, like the District of South Carolina is South Carolina. Some states are divided up into two or more districts. We're in the Western District of Michigan right now. Detroit is in the Eastern District. So saying that you have to be getting the jurors from the state and district where the crime was committed is usually no problem. You just get them from the right district and you're fine. The problem with this patch of Idaho is that the District of Wyoming, uniquely among all the districts, crosses state lines because it includes all of Yellowstone National Park. Part of Yellowstone is in Idaho, part of it's in Montana. So if you're in the Idaho portion of Yellowstone and you commit a crime, it would be a federal crime. The state has no jurisdiction there. They can't prosecute you. If you commit a crime there, the jury has to be from the state and district where the crime was committed. The state would be Idaho. The district would be the District of Wyoming. So the jurors would have to be from the Idaho portion of Yellowstone, but nobody lives there. So they couldn't give you a trial that follows the Sixth Amendment requirement.
How might the loophole be fixed? What have you been proposing?
Well, the simplest thing to do would be just to redraw the lines like every other district and say the District of Wyoming is Wyoming, the District of Idaho is Idaho, the District of Montana is Montana. That would fix it very easily just by doing that. There are some other ways around it where they might be able to prosecute people, and so they might not want to fix it. So the easiest way to get a conviction in a certain case might be to find some charge that you did something somewhere else, or you conspired to commit your crime in some other district, or one of the elements of the crime were somewhere else. But fixing it would just be as simple as making this district like every other district in the country.
And that would rest with the U.S. Congress?
Yes.
Then?
They wouldn't have to amend the Constitution, just pass a simple statute. And if they wanted to do it, it would be very simple. The hard part is getting them to want to do it.
Do congressional leaders from Wyoming and Idaho express any interest in this? Or to what extent has anyone in Congress expressed any interest in correcting this?
Well, Congress, as a general matter, is not interested in fixing hypothetical problems. They usually wait until something actually happens. They wait until powerful interest groups are agitating for things, and that doesn't really apply here. So there was not much interest in it. When the article first came out, I could not really get their attention. Their representative from that part of Idaho, Mike Simpson, went on record as saying that he wasn't worried if a crime occurred there. He wasn't worried because he said, first of all, that the state would be able to prosecute, which is just simply not true. I mean, it's just very clear as a matter of federal law, state law, the state has no jurisdiction. And then he said, well, the judicial system would prevail. They would find some way to remedy the murder should it occur. He didn't have a legal argument. And I'm not sure how you remedy a murder once it's occurred. Far better to prevent it by just redrawing the lines. There was a novel written based on this by C.J. Box called Free Fire, part of his Joe Pickett series, which have gotten really popular lately. But this this novel got the attention of Senator Enzi from Wyoming. And he read the novel, and he got very interested in fixing this. And at that point, I was talking to people on his staff, and I went from not having anyone pay attention to me to having people explain to me why they weren't going to do anything about it. Enzi wanted to fix it. He went to the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice said that they didn't want to fix it. And Senator Enzi, while he was interested in fixing it, didn't want to spend precious political capital on what was, after all, still a hypothetical issue. It's very hard to get anything passed in Congress. And if the Justice Department's against it, then that's going to make it even harder.
This all seems to suggest that a truly serious crime has never been committed in this area. Is that the case?
To my knowledge, there haven't been any crimes that have been prosecuted. It's a fairly remote part of the park. People do go there, but it's cut off from the rest of the park. There's no road from the rest of the park that goes there. It's maybe tens of thousands of people go there per year versus the millions that go to the rest of the park. So I'm not aware of any crimes having occurred, and frankly, I'm glad. I wrote the article with the hopes of getting this fixed, and if I'd known that 11 years later it would still not be fixed, maybe I would have thought about keeping it more quiet. Mm.
Were you ever worried that your writing would encourage someone to commit a crime like murder in this area?
Absolutely. When the article was accepted by the Georgetown Law Journal, I asked them if they could put it in the last issue of the volume because I wanted to try to get it fixed. And so that gave me about a year. And I thought that would be the best way to do it, to quietly notify the people who could do something about this and quietly fix it. Once that failed, the only way to get it done at that point was through getting attention. And that's what I've been trying to do since then. But you walk a tightrope there, getting enough attention to get it fixed without getting so much attention that you encourage someone to put theory into practice. I tell people, though, there are a lot of limits on the theory. You still face civil liability. The theory might not work. I have some reasons in the article why a court might interpret the Sixth Amendment to not mean what it says. But the main reason is that so many people have read this article. If you think you're going to go out to that part of Yellowstone and commit a crime, you should be aware that someone else probably has the same idea and he's bigger than you.
How discouraged have you become over this process, over talking about this and getting so little response?
I think for me, the worst part of it was not that I was disabused of any lofty notions I had of how a bill becomes a law. I mean, I know it's hard to get things through Congress. I think that the thing that bothered me the most was when the Justice Department told Senator Enzi that they didn't want to fix it, it wasn't because they thought I was wrong. They had two main reasons, and both of them were very discouraging to me. Their first reason was that they said, if we redraw the lines here, then part of Yellowstone will be in the District of Idaho, part will be in the District of Montana. Wyoming, where it is now, the District of Wyoming, is in the 10th Circuit. So federal appeals go to the 10th Circuit in Denver. The districts of Idaho and Montana are in the 9th Circuit. So the Justice Department's reason for not fixing this criminal law loophole, this beacon to would-be criminals, was that if they put part of the park in the 9th Circuit, then environmentalists would appeal park management decisions to the 9th Circuit, which is more liberal, instead of the 10th Circuit. And see, that's a bad reason on 2 points. One, it's very simple to just specify that the appeals would still go to the 10th Circuit. The Sixth Amendment only applies to criminal cases, and there's nothing inherent in this that would require this to go to the 9th Circuit. And the second reason is there are already cases from Yellowstone that go to the 9th Circuit. So I don't know what that reasoning emerged from, but it was enough to stop Senator Enzi because, again, you don't want to have to go up against the Justice Department over what is still a hypothetical issue. The second reason they had was more discouraging, and that is they expressed some confidence that even though that is what the Sixth Amendment requires, that they would still be able to get a conviction. And to me, that is both legally incorrect. They said it would be what's called harmless error. There are certain errors that you can make in a trial that if it doesn't affect the outcome, right, you're still guilty, then the court will just not worry about it. But there's a whole other category of errors where they won't say that. They'll say it doesn't matter if it affected the outcome or not. You have this right, and it is a violation, and so the trial is overturned. And legally, it's fairly clear to me that this would be in that second category where they wouldn't say it's just a harmless error. But even if it is, for the Justice Department to say in advance, if a case ever comes up, we intend to commit this error, right? We know that the Constitution requires something, but we're going to get it wrong. But don't worry, it's harmless. Instead of just fixing it, that was bothersome to me.
I'm speaking with MSU law professor Brian Kalt, who discovered there's an area of Yellowstone National Park where if a crime were committed, a loophole in the Sixth Amendment could prevent someone from being tried for the crime. You alluded to the novel by C.J. Box that used the zone of death as a plot device. What can you tell us about what happens there and how you respond to all of that?
Well, I don't want to give too much away, but in the novel, he has it's crime fiction. It's not a mystery. You know right away that the killer is this guy who's a lawyer. He kills some people in the Idaho portion of Yellowstone, and he turns himself in and then uses the loophole to go free. And I don't want to spoil too much about it, but just to say that there's more to the case than meets the eye, and all sorts of interesting things happen. But what was great about the novel, besides the attention that it brought to the issue, was that C.J. Box knows Wyoming like the back of his hand. He knows Yellowstone intimately. And so the one nagging thought that I had was, well, maybe this really is so remote that no one goes there, but he knows. People do go there.
And you went there.
Oh, no. I went to Yellowstone.
Oh, okay.
To help with the promotion of the book, to explain the legal issues. And when we were there, they said, hey, why don't we go to the Idaho portion and take some pictures? And I'm not going to tempt fate that badly.
Oh, interesting. Well, how did you first discover there was a loophole in the first place? How did you stumble onto this?
Well, I think this happens with a lot of loopholes. What happens is there's a constitutional provision or a legal provision that is just sort of forgotten. And in this case, it was the Sixth Amendment provision saying where the jury has to be from. Saying that the jury has to be from the state and district where the crime is committed is completely uncontroversial, so people don't pay any attention to it. It's one of the few rights in the Bill of Rights that hasn't been applied against the states. It's just sort of a forgotten part of the Sixth Amendment. There's another part that requires that the district lines be the ones that were in place when the crime was committed. So you can't go back after the fact and redraw the lines and try someone. But even that part hasn't really been tested in court. There's maybe one or two cases from 100 years ago. So I was writing about something else. I was writing about a certain sort of state statute, like we have one in Michigan like this. The Michigan statute says, if you commit a crime within 1 mile of the county line, they can try you in either county. And I'm from the Detroit area, and there was a case from 8 Mile Road, and it mattered very much in that case whether there was a Ferndale jury or a Detroit jury, and they used this statute, and they got a Ferndale jury, even though the crime was in Detroit. And that really bothered me, and I was writing an article about these statutes and about how important it is that the jury be from the right place. And I kept coming across these references to this District of Wyoming, across state lines. And they said, but this is of no consequence. And I said, I know, it is of consequence. And so I turned what was a footnote in that article into the perfect crime.
We've been speaking with MSU law professor Brian Kalt about a loophole in the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution that could allow the perfect crime to be committed in a small area of Idaho. He first discovered and wrote about the loophole over 10 years ago. It has still not been changed. Brian Kalt, thanks for joining us. Friday night, the combined forces of the Lansing Symphony, the MSU Choral Union, the University Chorale, and the State Singers will be on stage at the Wharton Center to perform one of the undeniable masterworks of musical history, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Current State's Jamie Paisley sat down with the maestro, Timothy Muffet, who will be conducting the concert, which contains one of the world's most famous melodies. Of course, what everyone knows is the Ode to Joy, a very famous melody and text that is in the conclusion of the symphony in the final movement. And that's the point where anyone would recognize this music. It's everywhere. But it's really a full-length experience, you know, in the way that watching a play or a movie is a full-length experience, and that every moment from the beginning to the end is crafted towards the end.
Yeah.
And the opening movements, for example, well, the first movement is just a headlong thrust without rest. There is just no moment of breath in the first movement. In a typical symphony sonata movement, there are really clearly articulated moments of what we call cadence, or where things kind of come to a pause, and perhaps it's a stopping point towards another destination. But it's interesting to me how that first movement never stops. It just, even when there's a second theme that changes the character and it's a little more lyrical, the arrival point is almost non-existent. It just appears, and there's still the sense of forward motion to it. And I find that the way that this whole symphony is put together is really that these first three movements are all leading up to the final movement, where the Ode to Joy appears.
The full forces.
Right. And there's an interesting balance to that final movement, too. It's the longest of all the movements, and as if to be that counterweight to the first three that build up to it.
And the texture changes in that final kind of 20 minutes or so for that final movement, like a secondary symphony within that symphony of itself.
Very much so. The instrumentation changes. Beethoven brings in a percussion section, which is unheard of in a Beethoven symphony up to this point. We've had no percussion aside from timpani, but he brings in bass drum, cymbals, triangle, the Janissary complement that he picked up from Haydn, who had done the same thing in his military symphony, and Mozart in The Abduction from the Seraglio. But here they appear in a symphony. He also, in the fourth movement, brings in the piccolo and the contrabassoon and the trombones. The trombones make a brief cameo appearance in the second movement, but they are really in the game in the fourth movement. Mm-hmm. So there, he beefs up the forces. And then, of course, he adds a chorus and four soloists, four vocal soloists in the final movement, too. So it's a dramatic shift from the sound world of the previous three movements.
Yeah.
Speaking with Maestro Timothy Muffet of the Lansing Symphony Orchestra about this Friday's concert at the Wharton Center in East Lansing, a performance anchored by the landmark final symphony by Beethoven, the Choral Symphony. And speaking of that choral element, how does that relationship work with the MSU College of Music? Since for the trio of choirs joining the LSO Friday night are the MSU Choral Union, the University Chorale, and the State Singers. Say one wanted to put on a choral symphony or a Brahms German Requiem. How does that process work with MSU?
Well, we've had a longstanding relationship with David Rail, who is an extraordinary colleague, and in musical ways and in just collaborative ways. You know, he and I speak, get together every year, and discuss what's coming up. And then he also works with his colleague, Jonathan Reed, in preparing the choruses. We have not only the students, but there's also the community component to the choruses as well. And they end up always sounding wonderful. And it's a collaboration that we really cherish in the Lansing Symphony.
Yeah. Are the soloists that are coming to this weekend's concert, where are they pulled from?
Well, these are all people that I have worked with in the past. When we have a quartet, you know, it's very important that the four singers be well suited to each other, which usually in this world means that they're at similar points of their career and similar points, not only of vocal development, but physiological development. Yeah. And because then you get a nice blended sound and
Heldon tenors sticking out.
Right, exactly. And I mean, the human voice is something that changes through one's lifetime and takes on different elements, remaining beautiful, but there's a difference between a 30-year-old voice and a 50-year-old voice. Not that one's better than the other, they're just different. And so I have a fairly large stable of singers with whom I've worked over the years, and so I kind of look into that stable, and some of these are people that our audience will recognize. Dominic Armstrong has sung with us before, the tenor. Jonathan Byer has sung with us before, both in classical, and he sang on a Holiday Pops. There will be some familiar faces up there, and then we have two wonderful ladies joining us as well.
Yeah. In terms of pedagogy, because obviously Professors David Rail and Jonathan Reed, they are focused a lot on bringing repertoire to the young voices of the chorus as well. But the LSO certainly has a large component of that as well. I mean, at the moment, I think you're still working on getting ready for the side-by-side part of teaching kids as well. Is that also one of the goals of having these large-scale chorus works?
Yes, I think it is, in that certainly the students of the Michigan State College of Music have many great performance opportunities within the College of Music. But here's an opportunity to come into a professional orchestra setting with a different audience and sing this extraordinary piece of music with extraordinary group of soloists. So yeah, it's hopefully a wonderful synergy that we create with the College of Music.
Yeah. Now, the Beethoven's Ninth ends with the famous Ode to Joy, which is also the anthem of the European Union. That is rather funnily paired with the coronation anthem used at every British monarch's coronation, dating back to 1727. And obviously, it's a funny pairing now in this kind of post-Brexit world that we're in. But what is that anthem?
Having a chorus on hand already for the end of the Beethoven Symphony, this seemed like a great time to do one of the Handel coronation anthems, Zadok the Priest, which has kind of had a life of its own since it was written for the coronation of King George and has appeared in many royal ceremonies in modern times. But from my perspective, what I love about it is the pairing of Handel and Beethoven. Beethoven, in his last period, what we kind of recognize as his last compositional period, really came back to the music of Handel very much, more than he had at any other point in his career. And we hear it in the contrapuntal writing, we hear it in the spirit of the music, and here's an opportunity to set that up as bookends, Handel opening the program, Beethoven closing the program. We've already got the chorus in place. It's a joyous, celebratory work, and it just fits into the theme of the evening very nicely.
And in the middle of that, we head into the town square with an American, kind of the guy when it comes to contemporary tonalist composers,
sure.
John Carigliano.
Right. And this piece, Gazebo Dances, it sounds exactly like what one would think when we hear a title, Gazebo Dances. It's joyous times, happy times in the summer, outdoors. One can conjure up any number of scenarios that would apply to this, but it's all joyous music.
The Lansing Symphony Orchestra plays John Carigliano's Gazebo Dances this Friday in a concert where Maestro Timothy Muffett will also be leading the MSU Choral Union, the University Chorale, and the State Singers in Handel's coronation anthem, Zadok the Priest. But the peak of Friday's concert is Beethoven's Ninth and Final Symphony, which concludes with his famous Ode to Joy. Tickets and more information can be found online at lansingsymphony.org. Maestro Timothy Muffett, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our show for today. Coming up Friday on Current State. If you were just 15 years old and in high school, would you care who becomes the next president?
Some people just sit there and they're like, oh, I'm not going to vote because, like, I don't know, I guess the smart people go and vote. Or some people don't care, but just one vote can count.
Holt High School students do care. They're holding a mock election. The students tell us their thoughts on taxes, poverty, and the candidates tomorrow. We hope you'll join us tomorrow as well. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.